not backing down. This girl is on fire. This girl is on fire. We're walking on fire. These girls are on fire. Put your hands in the
Good evening. For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Thursday, March 16th, 2017. A big sigh of relief today as City Hall exhales from the noose tightening around the neck of the de Blasio administration. Today, federal and state prosecutors said Mayor de Blasio and his staff won't face criminal charges. WBAI's Rebecca Miles has more.
Federal and state investigators were looking into whether Mayor de Blasio and his staff engaged in a pay-to-play scheme when fundraising during the mayor's run in 2013 and during the 2014 state senate effort. The federal inquiry centered on the mayor's campaign for One New York, which accepted donations from a mix of developers, unions, lobbyists, and other firms, some with business before the city, and was essentially a slush fund for the mayor. The state inquiry was more narrowly focused on whether the mayor and his aides violated state election law in 2014 by directing campaign donations to county committees to evade limits on contributions to individual candidates in the state Senate. Federal investigators questioned de Blasio for nearly 5 hours in February. He also sat down with the Manhattan District Attorney in December. Both the federal and state grand juries began hearing evidence in the probe at about the same time. In simultaneous announcements on Thursday, Acting U.S. Attorney Jun Kim and Manhattan District Attorney Cyrus Vance revealed the mayor will not be prosecuted in connection with the sketchy money-raising efforts. Kim said in a statement after a thorough investigation and taking into account the high burden of proof and the particularly difficulty of proving criminal intent and corruption schemes where there was no evidence of personal profit, quote, said, "We do not intend to bring criminal charges against the mayor or those acting on his behalf," end quote. Mayor de Blasio has repeatedly denied any wrongdoing.
I received the information the same way you did with the media reports today, and it simply confirms what I've said all along. My staff and my colleagues and I have acted in a manner that was legal and appropriate and ethical throughout. This is something I feel very strongly about in public service. That we have to comport ourselves in the proper manner, and we have done that, and that has been confirmed by the results of this investigation. I said throughout that we cooperated in every way that was asked of us, and I want to thank the U.S. Attorney's Office and the District Attorney's Office for diligently looking into this matter, for coming to conclusions and publishing those conclusions in a timely manner, given the fact that an election is looming. But we made clear throughout that we would cooperate in every way, and we proceeded to do that. I'd finally say a lot of time and energy has been spent on this.
Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance said the facts were insufficient to successfully argue a provable violation of state election laws, in part because the parties relied on the advice of attorneys. Vance said, however, it didn't mean he condoned the behavior. Rebecca Miles, WBAI News, New York.
In other news, Donald Trump's revised travel ban was blocked last night. Federal judges in Maryland and Hawaii rejected government arguments that the revised travel ban was different from the first one. Trump's own words were used as evidence that it discriminates against Muslims. Daniel Altshuler is with Make the Road New York.
Yesterday's ruling from the federal judge in Hawaii and in Maryland, both of those rulings were victories for justice and for the rule of law in this country against what we know to be an unconstitutional and unconscionable Muslim ban from the Trump administration.
Donald Trump reacted in Nashville, Tennessee by denigrating the Ninth Circuit Appeals Court.
The order he blocked was a watered-down version of the first order. That was also blocked by another judge and should have never been blocked to start with. This new order was tailored to the dictates of the Ninth Circuit's, in my opinion, flawed ruling. This is, in the opinion of many, an unprecedented judicial overreach. If he thinks there's danger out there, he or she, whoever is president, can say, I'm sorry, folks, not now, please. We got enough problems. We're talking about the safety of our nation, the safety and security of our people. We're going to fight this terrible ruling. We're going to take our case as far as it needs to go, including all the way up to the Supreme Court. We're going to win. We're going to keep our citizens safe. And regardless, we're going to keep our citizens safe. Believe me.
With no thought to the havoc he is reaping in immigrant communities. This was clearly evidenced at a city council hearing yesterday on immigration, where advocates and community members expressed the fear and concern in our communities. New York City Council Speaker Melissa Mark Vivedito.
Listen, I experienced that in my district. You know, I know constituents that are coming to us, that landlords are feeling emboldened, that they can harass tenants, invoking the name of Trump very specifically. So personally, in my district, I'm witnessing that, I'm experiencing that, and our advocates on the ground are saying the same thing. We had some very brave people on the panels yesterday talking about their personal experiences, and you can multiply that several times over. So this is an unfortunate reality, and it's really horrific that these are the times we're living. We are the safest city in this country, and the initiatives and the laws that we have in place have been in place for well over 5 years in some cases. You know, and so what is it that we are doing so wrong, right? They're trying to make a point on the backs of immigrant communities, of Muslim communities, and that's not fair. It's not right. And so we're going to continue to push back.
And resistance will continue, according to Make the Road New York.
So I think lots of immigrant rights organizations and Muslim rights organizations and refugee organizations are coming together or continuing to work together to fight against this ban as it moves forward through the courts. And we'll see that in the streets.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump and his inner circle have been busily drafting executive orders and budget proposals designed to fundamentally change the government. New York City's Mayor Bill de Blasio says Trump's budget will make New York less safe.
It'll make it harder to get affordable housing. It will hurt our schools. It will hurt our hospitals. This budget proposal will undermine the lives of millions of New Yorkers in various ways. And that's why we're going to fight it. We're not going to take it lying down. I believe that the president's budget has so many negative elements, and that the fight over this budget, at the same time as he's fighting for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which has met with massive resistance and opposition around the country, those two facts are going to go together. You're going to see more and more people, including people who voted for President Trump, disillusioned by the things they see in this budget proposal and willing to fight back.
Sally O'Brien has more.
Today, the Trump administration made public its budget proposal for fiscal year 2018, leaving little doubt as to where increased defense and homeland security funding, not to mention allocations for the promised Mexican border wall, would be coming from. While defense spending is increased by $54 billion, a majority of the operating budgets for the executive departments and agencies have been slashed by at least one-third. According to the Washington Post, the Environmental Protection Agency, the State Department, the Agricultural Department, and the Labor Department took the hardest hits, with EPA losing 31%, State 29%, while Labor and Agriculture cut 21% each. As part of a 16% reduction to the Department of Commerce's budget, the Trump administration is proposing sharp cuts to climate change and ocean research at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, massively disrupting medical and scientific research and monies for arts and humanities. The proposal also completely eliminates funding for 19 agencies, including the African Development Foundation, U.S. Trade and Development Agency, Chemical Safety Board, Corporation for Public Broadcasting, Institute for Museum and Library Services, the Legal Services Corporation, the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities, and the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, just to name a few. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi.
The federal budget should be a statement of our national values. What is important to us as a country should be reflected in how we allocate our resources in a budget. This budget is not a statement of values of anyone. That President Trump has shown that he does not value the future of our children and working families. It fails to recognize that the health of America, the strength of America, does not just depend on our military might, which is very important and we all support, but also our strength springs from the health, the education, and the well-being of the American people. Our strength depends on the power of our diplomacy, the health of our economy, and the vitality of our communities, all of which are undermined by the president's budget.
Of greater concern to some, while largely ignored by many, including the corporate media, was Donald Trump's March 13th executive order, quote, on a comprehensive plan for reorganizing the executive branch. Claiming constitutional and presidential authority, Trump's order asserted its intention to, quote, improve the efficiency, effectiveness, and accountability of the executive branch by mandating the director of the Office of Management and Budget to, quote, propose a plan to reorganize government functions and eliminate unnecessary agencies, components of agencies, and agency programs. OMB Director Mick Mulvaney, by the way, was one of the chief architects of the 2013 government shutdown. The order pledges to, quote, eliminate or reorganize unnecessary or redundant federal agencies and seeks overhaul plans from agency heads within 180 days. It specifies that agency heads need to examine whether agency functions and program, quote, are appropriate for the federal government or would be better left to state or local governments, or to the private sector through free enterprise. The order dovetails with Trump's earlier promise to seek $54 billion in cuts to civilian agencies and boost spending on Homeland Security and defense. In its March 14th online edition, Esquire magazine summed up their view of the executive order with the headline, "The executive branch is about to be reorganized into oblivion." Sally O'Brien, WBAI News, New York.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming at WBAI.org. In other news, adding insult to injury, the state of North Dakota now wants to recoup money it spent violating the rights of water protectors. Earth Mum has the story.
The state of North Dakota spent more than $38 million this past year protecting the building sites of the Dakota Access Pipeline from unarmed prayer groups of water protectors. Now the state is ready to seek reimbursement for this expenditure from the U.S. government, even though the owner of the Dakota Access Pipeline, Dallas-based billion-dollar company Energy Transfer Partners, offered to pay the state. Common Cause, a nonpartisan group which promotes government accountability, says accepting money from a private sector business in an industry it regulates presents the state with an ethical dilemma. Pipeline opponents long suspected North Dakota was working in the interest of Energy Transfer Partners and not in the interest and protection of the people who lived on the land, with over 800 unarmed water protectors arrested over the last 10 months. Joy Braun of the Indigenous Environmental Network said, for Energy Transfer Partners to offer a donation, basically that's paying off the state for using resources as personal security. Earth Mom, WBAI News, New York.
In local news, New York City is about to fix a problem in Southeast Queens, flooding, which affects more than 400,000 city residents. Queens Council Member Donovan Richards.
We need some hammers in the ground and to finally update our infrastructure in a way that it should have been updated probably 30 or 40 years ago. I just don't get how a city would build out homes, would build out buildings, and not put in any storm sewers in communities. And this basically came down to environmental racism. And it's no way around it. There were parts of Queens that were built out. When we looked at the map, we could clearly see where a lot of infrastructure investment was being placed, where a lot of dollars were going. But when you got to southern communities of color in Southeast Queens, we did not see any equity. We did not see the funding. We were promised year in and year out that this problem would be addressed, and it never was.
$1.7 billion has been secured to solve the problem. In other local news, Manhattan Council member Yadonis Rodriguez sponsored legislation which would eliminate distinctions between individual and mini-fleet yellow taxi medallions. Council member Rodriguez.
And I would like to dedicate our legislation to the 6,000 individual medallion owners in the city of New York that bought a train that they will have the exclusive right to do a straight pickup in our city, that they have seen the value of those medallions being going down. I believe that, you know, it is time for us to think about those 6,000 men and women that use the value of those medallions to apply for loan to send the kids to college or also to get it buy a new house. It is no secret that the yellow taxi industry is facing very challenging times right now. Fares and trips are down considerable, and perhaps more significantly, hundreds of taxis are sitting idling instead of being out on the road where they belong serving New Yorkers. While there are many factors behind this, the bottom line is that the yellow taxi is an iconic part of New York City and an important transportation option for New Yorkers and visitors alike. With these bills, we are taking a step to ease some of the restrictions and administrative burdens that medallion owners, especially the 6,000 individual medallion owners, currently face.
The hope is to make the iconic yellow taxi and its medallions more attractive for investment. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. And finally, New Yorkers voted for their favorite book. It's part of the citywide reading project, One Book, One New York. It's a book about a young couple fighting against the odds of race, class, and immigration to achieve success. It's called Americana, and it's by Chiamanda Ngozi Adichie. Here's an excerpt, followed with details by Dominic Jack.
Chapter 1. Princeton, in the summer, smelled of nothing. And although Ifemelu liked the tranquil greenness of the many trees, the clean streets and stately homes, the delicately overpriced shops, and the quiet abiding air of earned grace, it was this, the lack of a smell, that most appealed to her. Perhaps because the other American cities she knew well had all smelled distinctly. Philadelphia had the musty scent of history. New Haven smelled of neglect. Baltimore smelled of brine, and Brooklyn of sun-warmed garbage. But Princeton had no smell. She liked taking deep breaths here. She liked watching the locals who drove with pointed courtesy and parked their latest model cars outside the organic grocery store on Nassau Street, or outside the sushi restaurants, or outside the ice cream shop that had 50 different flavours, including red pepper, or outside the post office, where effusive staff bounded out to greet them at the entrance. She liked the campus, grave with knowledge, the Gothic buildings with their vine-laced walls, and the way everything transformed in the half-light of night into a ghostly scene. She liked most of all that in this place of affluent ease, she could pretend to be someone else, someone specially admitted into a hallowed American club, someone adorned with certainty. But she did not like that she had to go to Trenton to braid her hair. It was unreasonable to expect a braiding salon in Princeton. The few black locals she had seen were so light-skinned and lank-haired, she could not imagine them wearing braids. And yet, as she waited at Princeton Junction Station for the train, on an afternoon ablaze with heat, she wondered why there was no place where she could braid her hair. The chocolate bar in her handbag had melted. A few other people were waiting on the platform, all of them white and lean, in short, flimsy clothes. The man standing closest to her was eating an ice cream cone. She had always found it a little irresponsible, the eating of ice cream cones by grown-up American men, especially the eating of ice cream cones by grown-up American men in public. He turned to her and said, "About time," when the train finally creaked in, with a familiarity strangers adopt with each other after sharing in the disappointment of a public service. She smiled at him. The greying hair on the back of his head was swept forward, a comical arrangement to disguise his bald spot. He had to be an academic, but not in the humanities, or he would be more self-conscious. A firm science like chemistry, maybe. Before, she would have said, "I know,"
that peculiar American expression that professed agreement rather than knowledge, and then she would have started a conversation with him to see if he would say something she could use in her blog. People were flattered to be asked about themselves, and if she said nothing after they spoke, it made them say more. They were conditioned to fill silences. If they asked what she did, she would say vaguely, "I write a lifestyle blog." Because saying, "I write an anonymous blog called Raceteenth or Various Observations about American Blacks, those formerly known as Negroes by a non-American black," would make them uncomfortable. She had said it, though, a few times. Once to a dreadlocked white man who sat next to her on the train, his hair like old twine ropes that ended in a blonde fuzz, his tattered shirt worn with enough piety to convince her that he was a social warrior and might make a good guest blogger. "Race is totally overhyped these days. Black people need to get over themselves. It's all about class now, the haves and the have-nots," he told her evenly. And she used it as the opening sentence of a post titled, "Not all dreadlocked white American guys are down." Then there was the man from Ohio who was squeezed next to her on a flight. A middle manager, she was sure, from his boxy suit and contrast collar. He wanted to know what she meant by lifestyle blog, and she told him, expecting him to become reserved or to end the conversation by saying something defensively bland like, "The only race that matters is the human race." But he said, "Ever write about adoption? Nobody wants black babies in this country. And I don't mean biracial, I mean black. Even the black families don't want them." He told her that he and his wife had adopted a black child, and their neighbours looked at them as though they had chosen to become martyrs for a dubious cause. Her blog post about him, "Badly dressed white middle managers from Ohio are not always what you think," had received the highest number of comments for that month. She still wondered if he had read it. She hoped so. Often she would sit in cafes or airports or train stations, watching strangers, imagining their lives, and wondering which of them were likely to have read her blog, now her ex-blog. She had written the final post only days ago, trailed by 274 comments so far. All those readers, growing month by month, linking and cross-posting, knowing so much more than she did. They had always frightened and exhilarated her. Sapphic Derrida, one of the most frequent posters, wrote, "I'm a bit surprised by how personally I'm taking this. Good luck as you pursue the unnamed life change, but please come back to the blogosphere soon. You've used your irreverent, hectoring, funny, and thought-provoking voice to create a space for real conversations about an important subject."
A reading from the book Americana by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. New Yorkers across the city took to the ballots once again, but this time to vote for Americana, the winner of a citywide reading project. Over 1,500 copies of the book will be donated to libraries in all 5 boroughs. Inscribed will offer free access to the Americana audiobook for 90 days. Columbia University will engage participants in artistic activities, reader discussions, and podcasts or book clubs. BuzzFeed will connect with young readers through Facebook Live videos and events at the Manhattan Housing Works bookstore. The book, Americana, follows the story of two young lovers who must separate because of messy immigration laws. Ifemelu is a smart and successful young woman who is faced with being racialized after her move to America. Her boyfriend, Obinzi, is forced to live a dangerous and undocumented life in London after being kept out of a fearful post-9/11 America. But the book also explores timely and controversial themes: race, identity, culture, class, and love. For more information on where to grab the book and join in the citywide events, log on to nyc.gov/onebook. Dominique Jack, WBAI News, New York.
And that's the WBAI Evening News for Thursday, March 16th, 2017. The news was produced with Rebecca Miles, Sally O'Brien, Earth Mom, Dominique Jack, and Reggie Johnson. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.